News. I'm Bob Levicky. Gas prices continue to climb in Virginia as Trump's war in Iran stretches on. Governor Spanberger orders Virginia's return to a multi-state voter partnership called ERIC. And in the face of increasing federal restrictions on care for people in LGBTQ communities, we meet one Charlottesville area physician who continues to specialize in their care. This is the WMRA Daily for Thursday, March 26th. Gas prices in the WMRA region have increased more than 20% since President Trump launched his war on Iran nearly 4 weeks ago. The website Gas Buddy shows prices in our area now averaging around $3.90 for a gallon of regular gas, and that matches a nationwide trend. Governor Abigail Spanberger ordered the state elections commissioner to rejoin the Electronic Voter Information Center in an executive order on Tuesday. Virginia was a founding member of ERIC, a multi-state voter data partnership, but left the agreement under former Governor Glenn Youngkin after it became the subject of far-right conspiracy theories. 26 member states share registration data with each other to improve voter roll accuracy. Spanberger said that the action is critical to ensuring all eligible Virginia residents can cast a ballot. Meanwhile, Spanberger has also issued an order ending the purging of voter rolls just before an election. The Richmond Times-Dispatch reports that the governor's executive order would prohibit the kind of purging that happened in Virginia in the weeks before the 2024 election under former Governor Glenn Youngkin. Spanberger's order says that any program to remove names from voting rolls must be completed 90 days before a federal election, and the order reiterates several long-standing election security measures. Legislation to the same effect did not make it out of the General Assembly this year. The governor named Josephus Almond as Virginia's first chief energy officer. She signed an executive order Wednesday establishing the new cabinet-level position. The governor said the role was created to address rising energy costs and develop a statewide energy strategy. Previously, Almond worked as an attorney with the Southern Environmental Law Center. Virginia legislators are still hammering out a budget. The Commonwealth's free clinics are hoping that means more state funding, especially as federal cuts are expected to eviscerate services. Radio IQ's Brad Kuttner reports.
You can't get blood from a turnip, right?
That's Ashley Green with the Western Tidewater Free Clinic in Suffolk. She's been in the business of serving some of Virginia's most needy for 12 years, and she said costs, from staff to medication and everything in between, have skyrocketed.
Anyone running a household to a business knows things just cost more. What we're all facing with the current landscape and what's coming our way is the need to do more and less money to do it with.
That warning comes before changes in President Donald Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill kick in. It's expected to see hundreds of thousands of Virginians lose health care, driving more patients to free clinics like the ones Green runs or to emergency rooms at a higher cost. Rufus Phillips is CEO of the Virginia Association of Free and Charitable Clinics, the group that advocates for free clinics at the legislature. He said their network usually gets about $8 million a year from the state, but they need more, $15 million more, to meet the coming demand. But current estimates now put the funding closer to $5 million. Phillips said that's not enough.
That added demand is going to really stress the healthcare system in Virginia. And free clinics are on the front line, Brad, when it comes to trying to take care of the uninsured. Things may be challenging now for the free clinics, but they're going to be a lot more challenging over these next few years.
Budget negotiations are ongoing with a late April target for a final deal. Whether or not clinics get the funding they say they need remains to be seen. In Richmond, I'm Brad Kuttner.
Governor Spanberger is considering a bill that would allow for more cameras to catch speeding drivers. Also with Radio IQ, Michael Pope has the details.
For Delegate Holly Siebold, a Democrat from Vienna, the need for cameras to catch speeding drivers is underscored by a tragedy that happened in her district.
In 2022, three of my constituents were walking home from Oakton High School and were struck by a speeding driver, another student at the school who was driving 80 miles per hour in a 35 mile per hour zone.
Two students died and one was injured. The speeding student is in prison, and Siebold is sending a bill to the governor's desk that allows for speed cameras in so-called red zones, areas designated by the Virginia Department of Transportation as some of the most dangerous. She says cameras will make people slow down, but Republican Senator Mark Peek of Lynchburg says officers will make people slow down, not cameras.
I think we need more officers if we want to make the roads more safe. The problem with these speed cameras is a vast chunk of money is going to out-of-state companies and corporations, and all they're doing is fining people. We need cars on the road. We need officers on the road, and that gets people's attention, and that makes them actually slow down.
To pass the bill, Siebold agreed to a compromise that limits the cameras to Northern Virginia. She says she would like to see the governor amend the bill to allow them in red zones across Virginia. The governor has about 2 weeks to make a decision on this bill and hundreds of others. Michael Pope.
It's been more than a year since the University of Virginia's Board of Visitors compelled UVA health clinicians to scale back care for existing transgender patients younger than 19. The decision was the result of bans issued by the Trump administration. Amidst a rapidly changing legal landscape, one Charlottesville area physician continues to specialize in trans care. Christine Cuter has her story.
In the early 2000s, Catherine Casey had medical school friends who had to trek to an infectious disease clinic to get physicals.
Because primary care doctors were not trained in how to screen appropriately for sexually transmitted infections in gay men. This was completely wild to me, seeing as they were just regular, healthy 22-year-olds looking for a checkup.
She later talked to LGBTQ patients who'd been escorted out of doctor's offices, denied eye exams, and treated like objects of curiosity, including one trans patient who woke up in the ER with no pants.
As they had seen in her chart that she had had gender-affirming surgery and were curious, there was a general lack of understanding as to who transgender people were, where they fit in the LGBTQ health spectrum, and certainly no discussion of their healthcare needs in my training.
Today, Casey specializes in adult LGBTQ care, and her practice sees about 1,000 such patients from all over the state, including many who identify as trans. She also teaches medical and nursing students how to talk with, touch, and assess LGBTQ patients.
Tailoring your approach so that you do your best to first do no harm, which is one of the fundamental rules that we have to follow as physicians and healthcare providers.
Though she established UVA Health's first transgender clinic a decade ago as a monthly one-off, she's since decided that integrating them is better. Casey ensures that everyone, from medical trainees to the frontline office staff, are
supportive and fluent in using LGBTQ terminologies. That's absolutely how it should be in my mind. LGBTQ health should be just a routine part of primary care that all primary care doctors are familiar with, the same way they're familiar with treating diabetes, hypertension, low back pain, sinus infections, and the rest of it.
While UVA Health continues to provide transgender care to adults, shifts in care for young trans patients are less clear. Casey has seen the changes firsthand.
I had never seen my pediatric colleagues break down and cry before, but that was honestly one of the factors which made me feel like I had to double down even harder and make sure that this work was done for them too. It was utterly unfair that some of my colleagues were going to never see their patients again, who they had been caring for years, based on something so cruel and arbitrary.
There are other erosions too.
So if I send a bill to a health insurance company and I said, I checked somebody's testosterone level and hematocrit because they have gender dysphoria, the health insurance company is supposed to pay for the lab cost that I ordered. And what we're finding is certain health insurance companies have stopped doing that across the board. Medications for patients related to the diagnosis of gender dysphoria are being denied by certain healthcare insurance companies. And that's not something which they've been forced to do by any federal statute, but it's something that they've chosen to do.
And that's dangerous because patients who stop taking hormones risk getting osteoporosis and things like hip fractures, even in their teens and 20s. Casey emphasizes transgender Virginians shouldn't and aren't going anywhere.
They're just like you and me. They're just trying to get by. They are absolutely everywhere and unavoidable. Whether you recognize them or not, they are serving you at restaurants, checking you out at the grocery store, and frequently they're your colleagues and people at work, whether or not you figured that out yet.
Reporting from Charlottesville, I'm Christine Cuter.
At WMRA's December Books and Brews, we met foraging expert Gabrielle Serberville, who teaches that hunting local mushrooms can be exciting. Chanterelles and black trumpets, morels and oyster mushrooms, chicken of the woods, hen of the woods, and giant puffballs. Dave Cantor has more on legislative proposals focused on mushrooms in Virginia.
About 24 members of the Blue Ridge Mycological Society follow a dirt path in rural Schuyler through trees and abundant plant life during early March. They're looking for an entry point to the kingdom of fungi. Gabrielle Serberville is part of that group, and last year published Gathered on Foraging, Feasting, and the Seasonal Life, an exploration of wild edibles and their place in our changing appetites. Mushrooms are among that fare, though fungi can also be used to make fabric, furniture, building materials, and a film that can replace plastic. Serberville isn't dubious about the industrial or health applications of mushrooms, but said medicinal claims need to be properly researched and vetted.
I think that fungal medicine does hold a lot of promise if we can get people to stop making sensationalized claims about things before we've gone through actual clinical trials. But many of our daily medicines are fungal. We wouldn't have antibiotics without fungi.
A General Assembly bill this session proposed creating the Virginia Fungi Task Force. The panel of scientists, environmentalists, and state officials would have examined, quote, the economic potential of fungi in the Commonwealth. But after being approved by the House, it was later continued until next year, meaning it could be revived and passed at a later date. During a Senate committee hearing on the proposal in February, officials also heard how mushrooms can affect the health of the state's environment and watershed.
We can use mushrooms in both soil health and in their role in keeping our forests healthy to protect the Chesapeake Bay, so their relationship is very closely linked.
That's Jay Ford, Virginia policy manager for the Chesapeake Bay Foundation, who spoke in favor of the task force bill.
And so this would be our first step towards getting our arms around what should be here, what we're losing through impacts of climate change, what those impacts are to our forests and soils, and potentially what some economic development opportunities are, as we are currently sending a lot of raw materials to other states to grow mushrooms that we could be using here.
Thousands of fungal species have been identified in Virginia, and it's possible that more exist that haven't been cataloged. Among those are mushrooms containing psilocybin, a hallucinogenic substance, in more than 100 species that have been used for recreational and medicinal purposes. It's a Schedule I substance at the federal level. Legislative proposals approved by the House and Senate this year direct the state to reschedule psilocybin if and when it's reassessed by the U.S. FDA. Governor Abigail Spanberger has until April 13th to act on those bills. Rytis Vilgelis is a Duke University biology professor. He began researching mushrooms at the Mountain Lake Biological Station in Giles County when he was a Virginia Tech undergrad student. He said the area is one of the most pristine places he's done fieldwork.
The Blue Ridge area always has been sort of a famous hotspot for biodiversity, you know, whether you're talking salamanders or plants or fungi. So there's a long history there, but when you layer on top of all that history, there's the last 20, 30 years, this realization that there's even more diversity that we haven't been able to really put our finger on yet.
That unstudied pool of fungi could be at risk because of climate change and development. Figuring out what those mushrooms do in the environment and what they might do in the lab is partially why the Blue Ridge Mycological Society exists.
What attracts me to mushrooms is the fact that they are sort of the hinge between life and death. You know, they're the thing that makes life after death possible.
Serberville, the educator and author, explained her interest in the fungal world while standing underneath a tree canopy in Schuyler. She described its underground machinations, sometimes called the Wood Wide Web, and the reciprocal relationship mushrooms have with surrounding trees and plant life.
Because so many fungi are decomposers, they are what we rely on to, like, decompose things, to decompose dead stuff, dead trees, to make soil, to create connections within forest systems. You don't have forests without fungi.
I'm Dave Kancher.
To see our December Books and Brews conversation with Gabrielle Serberville, go to WMRA.org, mouse over events, and click on Books and Brews. Finally today, over the past weekend, the U.S. Army honored several ROTC cadets at Old Dominion University for their bravery and sacrifice during a shooting that killed their professor. The cadets stopped the gunman in Constant Hall on March 12th. The gunman also died in the attack. The Army awarded the cadets 8 Meritorious Service Medals and 2 Purple Hearts during a private ceremony on Sunday. Army Secretary Dan Driscoll and Sergeant Major Michael Weimer handed out the medals. For WMRA News, I'm Bob Levicky. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoy your Thursday.